Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
I'm Ilona Thompson, Palate Exposure. I am here in Sonoma at Small Vines with Paul, who actually has been somewhat quietly but steadfastly changing the scene in Sonoma County. He created some extraordinary feats with his vineyard and with his viticultural practices, widely admired by his peers and the consumers that find the brand. It's a bit of a best kept secret. We're here to let you guys listen to his story and also get to know him and what he creates and why he does it. It's a very special opportunity. So we'll start in the beginning. You were raised in Sonoma County, so this is your backyard. You were born in...
I was born in Eastern Santa Rosa, yeah, on a 250-acre horse and cattle ranch.
Yeah.
My grandparents moved out to Sonoma County from Pennsylvania in the 1940s. Mm-hmm. And my grandfather was a doctor. He was an OBGYN, delivered over 10,000 babies in Sonoma County. But his passion, other than helping people in the medical world, was to be a cowboy. So we did not grow grapevines on the ranch, but I learned what hard work was about at a very early age, and I absolutely loved growing up on that property. And quite frankly, when I found wine in the restaurant world, I knew that this was my opportunity to get back onto ranching and raising my kids in nature, and why we farm organically, and you know, all of these things stem from this kind of experience as a youth growing up on a 250-acre ranch, where when I came home from school, my first opportunity was to jump on my horse and go for a bareback horseback ride across the property I lived on, rather than do homework or... So it was an amazing way to experience Sonoma County.
Wow, so you're really... A lot of people have moved here and love Sonoma County, and a lot of people grew up in the area, but what you're describing is a very hands-on, you know, very entrenched experience when every aspect of what rural upbringing is.
Yeah.
You know exactly what that is. So as a young person, have you ever thought about, you know, you've been surrounded by vines, clearly, but have you thought about your own participation in it, or was it just as an extension of you tasting wines?
Well, I had some pretty interesting experiences. My grandfather had a great friend, Eddie Crepazzi, and Eddie was the typical Italian man. He bought salt and pepper from the grocery store, and that was about it. He made everything else. He grew his own grapes. He made his own Italian wine. Of course, it was quite strong and intense as a young man. I didn't appreciate what it was, but it was part of a celebration. Every time we harvested something, we, you know, had a tiny sip of wine and broke bread and had salami, and it was a great experience. I started working in the restaurant industry in Sonoma County when I was 14, and started bussing tables at a steakhouse in Santa Rosa. Soon moved to Cafe Chiti in Kenwood and worked with Luca and Linda there, where I not only worked in the kitchen, but I served tables. And then I had the pleasure of working with Susan and Max at a Swiss-French, well, it wasn't a Swiss-French restaurant, they were Swiss-French, in Kenwood, called the Kenwood Restaurant and Bar. That was my first exposure at 19 years old to Pinot Noir. And of course, they were very strict Swiss French. I couldn't taste or drink Pinot Noir. But every night they would open a bottle of Pinot Noir and they would put the glass under my nose and smell this, the bouquet, the potpourri, the fruit, the elegance. And this was every night that I worked, this was my experience with them. I worked there for 3.5 years as a busboy. We had lifetime waiters. The waiters there were there, the earliest was 16 years to 25 years. So people loved working there. They were treated well and had a good living there. So of course I wanted to be a waiter. So I took a lunch job at John Ash & Company. And John Ash & Company, this was in 1993. I started waiting tables there. I was 20 years old, almost 21 years old. And they had one of those wine lists that was to be revered anywhere in the world. They had Domaine Romani Conti from the 1970s. They had Italian wines, deep French Burgundy, and deep old California. Chalon, Stony Hill, Mount Eden, Joseph Swan, William Salium. I mean, just all of the iconic Hanzel. I mean, the list can just go on, but we had this wonderful old California selection. And the day I turned 21, I went to my general manager and said, look, I know nothing about wine, but we have this amazing wine list and I'm quite intimidated waiting tables and knowing nothing about wine. I see on Wednesdays you have people sharing wine. Can I sit in on the wine tastings? And from that day forward, he said, yes, you can sit in on the wine tastings. I'm not going to pay you. You're volunteering your time. You spit everything you taste. We'll taste up to 150 wines in a day. You need to spit every wine that you taste. You can't ask too many questions about the wines because we have so many to get through if you ask questions to learn. But I have 50 books on wine in my office. You're welcome to read here at the restaurant any of my books, and you can research any of the comments that you have questions on. I want you to take notes about every single wine. I want you to write down the name, the vintage, the varietal of every single wine that you taste, and I want you to try to write a tasting comment, something about the wine, write a question that they talked about that you didn't know, write a tasting note. And they started off very simple. Oh, yum, yuck, you know, smells like Band-Aids. Went through a lot of Band-Aids growing up on a ranch, so I knew what Band-Aids smelled like. Soon to learn it was kind of a form of Brettanomyces usually that smelled like Band-Aids. But that experience really started fueling my passion for connecting the land to wine and food. So for 6 months, I tasted every Wednesday. I visited most of those iconic wineries, Mount Eden Vineyard, Stony Hill, William Salium, Joseph Swan. I visited 65 different wineries during the 6 months, all volunteering just from tasting intriguing wines. And the restaurant wine buyer resigned, and they came to me and said, look, you're very young, but you're passionate. Would you like to, you know, be involved in buying the wines at the restaurant? And very sheepishly, I said yes, because I didn't know enough to buy the wines at that level of restaurant, but I didn't do it alone. There were other people involved, but I was involved with the wine program there for 2 years. And that was really where wine came a part of my life. So it was very, you know, progressive. I was aware of wine in Sonoma County. I was aware of the vineyards. I helped Eddie Capazzi make wine in his, you know, little cellar at his home on Los Alamos Road. But I didn't really understand the world of wine until John Ash & Company. But my passion for Pinot Noir was inspired first by Max and Susan at the Kenwood restaurant. And I have a lot to thank them for with that.
There's so much to unpack, right? And those comments that you made, first of all, what stood out to my ear is, of course, I wanted to be a waiter. These days, I think People say, I want to be a song. Everybody wants to be a rock star. Waiter, especially in the iteration that you're describing, such a noble profession. You're really someone that is your ally in a restaurant. And unfortunately, it's a lost art, I'm afraid. But you've experienced what it should be like and what it was like. And that trial by fire, being exposed to that many phenomenal wines, it's such a unique experience because, you know, how many of us can say that we've tasted old California and Bordeaux and Burgundy, the illustrious producers, side by side, most likely, I'm guessing, in a controlled setting. So early on when, you know, you're blank slate, that had to have given you an incredible cross-section of what that world can deliver.
It's so amazing how life is kind of a connection of experiences. It's like the cartoons where a light bulb goes off in your mind when you have an ethereal experience, but they connect. It's like dot to dot, this connection of your life moving forward. So, you know, when I first started tasting wine, you know, jammy, ripe Zinfandel in the mid-90s was kind of my favorite. The fruit. But it didn't take but a few weeks before acidity, balance, and elegance. When I started tasting chef's food, which was very delicate, we had a lot of wild game, elk and venison and wild fowl, pheasant, that's quail, that sort of thing. When you started tasting wine with chef's cuisine, you realize that many wines masked the delicacy of what he was putting on the plate, where the food was so kind of pristine, the quality of the ingredients were so wonderful that if you didn't have elegance, it was in clash with the food. So it was pretty quick that it took me back to elegant Pinot Noir, low alcohol, bright acidity, and my job was to find the right wine for the guest that was dining in our restaurant for where they were in their journey, but also that would complement chef's food. So using the word somm, and I have so much respect for how far the wine industry has come in the 26 years that I've been involved with wine in a very serious way. And you notice I didn't call myself a somm. I was involved in buying the wines. I was a wine steward. I went through the Sterling Vineyard School of Service and Hospitality with Evan Goldstein at Sterling Vineyards. I thank John Ash for sponsoring me through that. That was just a wonderful experience. That's where I learned to evaluate wine, how to pair wine with food. But I was still a wine steward. I'm not a sommelier. I wasn't a sommelier. I was a steward to the wines, and service was the number one most important thing. The hospitality, welcoming people to our restaurant, finding what were they looking for? What experience did they want at that restaurant? Why were they there? If they loved white Zinfandel, could I take them one step on the ladder to maybe a motion Pinot Noir where they were enjoying a red wine, but it was elegant and delicate enough that they could really enjoy red wine for the first time in their life, where prior to that, it was too much on their palate. Those experiences were what I was looking for. And I have a shoebox still full of thank you cards of people from Texas or from Illinois or from New York writing back to the restaurant saying thank you for introducing me to a red wine I could enjoy. And I really relish in the hospitality, and being a producer now, it comes full circle. For the first time, you know, when I open a tasting experience at my winery and I can invite people out by appointment to do that, I get to host people in my realm to share my vision of where I felt wine could go in California, and it's all about hospitality again. But it's from 10 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Not until 1 or 2 in the morning. So it's very different. It fits the family lifestyle much, much better. I'm sure my two children enjoy the fact that I'm home at dinner time most nights. So,
you know, whether you consciously realize that or not, you're perfectly positioned with your background to become a vintner. And I know you're also viticulturist, we'll talk about it in a minute, but that winning combination of having the exposure to so many different versions of greatness in the wine world, because obviously you have to be very picky, but also having the consumer in mind and their needs and wants. That's a very unique combination. A lot of people, you know, are highly competent when it comes to winemaking. They go to UC Davis or some other school, and they certainly taste a lot of wine, but not everybody tastes and have the opportunity, the wherewithal, to taste that caliber of wines, and that really brings a whole other level to your experience. And I know you said that you're not a sommelier, you haven't identified yourself as such, but in fact you were doing that job, and some of the best sommeliers that I have come in contact with, again, it's almost, I hesitate to say it, but it's almost a European mindset. When again, they're there to really shepherd the experience, and they're part psychologists.
Yes.
You know, part, you know, servers. They really physically get involved in, the ritual of opening wine, but they also read your mind, really, even sometimes things you can't articulate. So that culture that also, of course, exists in this country. I'm just saying that, you know, here sometimes there's other versions when it's a bit more flighty. But I think the true profession of the sommelier, again, a very noble profession, is the, you know, to be there for the guests in every way and to help them understand what they want, even when they don't. And that's a very complex equation.
Right.
And the fact that you were so entrenched in it, like you said, till all the late hours, and at the time you had the wherewithal and the capacity, I think it prepared you so well for what you do today.
It was a really pivotal time in the wine industry in California.
Yeah.
We were in this transition. 1993 was kind of the height of the... A lot of vineyards had been replanted post-phylloxera. So phylloxera was a little root louse that was killing a rootstock that... Originally, we thought was resistant to phylloxera. It was called AXR rootstock. But phylloxera mutated, and now this rootstock that most California vineyards were planted to, or many were planted to, was failing to phylloxera. So in the mid-1980s, this massive replanting, and when we were replanting, we were changing the vineyard architecture, and it was changing the style of wine. A lot of people, I think now, think that, well, this is what California does, and I feel that it's what we did to California, because I saw wines from the 60s, 70s, and 80s that had good natural acidity, were balanced in their alcohol, that the winemakers did not have to add acid to these wines. And I saw them in the mid-90s drinking them from the 70s at 15 years old, and they still had life in front of them. They were still beautiful wines and had a story to tell for many years to come. And I aspire to make wines that are very approachable the day I release them, but I also aspire to have wines that can tell a story for a long time if you so choose to experience that story over 15 or 20 years, if that's what you're looking for in wine. So when you tasted those old wines, and I saw the drinking window shortening with the newer wines, I saw the acidification of wines being necessary, the alcohol rising, in some cases the pairing with food not being quite so easy with those wines. They're delicious wines, but the complement to food was more like you wanted to enjoy the wine on its own and then have food, or have the wine after food. But it wasn't the same complement that I had experienced. So I started researching that level. And that really started to intrigue me. I guess the kind of engineering, the mathematical, the scientific side of me started asking what changed. And vineyard architecture is kind of a term that I've coined to describe what changed. See, California, and I studied a lot of the history of the wines in Burgundy and the vineyards in Burgundy and what phylloxera did to Burgundy, and then what Prohibition did to California. And post-Prohibition, when people started planting vineyards in California, we were mostly orchard farmers. We were farming prunes and plums and apples and cherries and a host of many other fruits. But the tractor became available to farmers, and we were farming these orchards with very large, very wide wheelbase tractors for stability. And when Prohibition got lifted, we literally stuck our tractor in a blank field, and we said, well, we need a 12-foot wide tractor row, and we need a fruiting wire up at 42 inches so that we can fit the wheels underneath it. And we built a vineyard. We designed a trellis system around the tractor. 1933, this is where the 12-foot California sprawl trellis system got invented. Brilliant, right? Farmers are pragmatic. They have a tractor. Now I can farm my orchards and my vineyards with the same tractor. Well, that created a beautiful umbrella of canopy, shading the fruit, ripening the fruit more through photosynthetic energy in the plant rather than direct sunlight on the fruit. And my feeling was when phylloxera was removing those vineyards and we were replanting, we narrowed our tractor row to 8 feet. We were having to use a trellising system that Burgundy invented to fit a horse down their tractor row, their vine row, of a 1 meter wide. But our tractors, we could fit down an 8 foot tractor row. Well, 8 feet is much wider. The sun angles are going to allow twice the amount of direct sunlight on the fruit by us trapping the foliage vertically, this VSP, we call it, vertical shoot positioning. And that, to me, this light bulb went off one day that is the change to California, where sunlight into wine is good, but we're adding maybe a little too much. And I'm very specific. I'm a Pinot Noir and Chardonnay producer. So when I talk, I am not talking about every variety that can be grown in California. I'm talking about the craft that I am working. The craftsmanship that I am after is to make a Chardonnay and a Pinot Noir that has no manipulation, no change, no acidification, no water additions, no enzymes, no need to manipulate anything. I would say I won't say I'm not manipulating my wines, because I'm manipulating my vines tremendously in my vineyard. But I want it to be natural. I don't want my manipulations to be additions or subtractions or removing alcohol or adding water. I want it to be manipulating the fruit that I harvested into the best, coaxing it into the best bottle of wine that I can possibly have, expressing that vintage that those grapes were grown. So that was kind of what my quest became. And it was all from the restaurant world, that all of these ideas from tasting 1978 Domaine Romani Conti Vineyard Pinot Noir that was $3,500 a bottle, but I had a very generous man that shared a glass of it with me one night. He was dining by himself, and you taste that and you, wow, this is what Pinot Noir can be? I had no idea. I'd never had that level of an experience. I had had some phenomenal bottles of French Burgundy. I had had some phenomenal bottles of California Pinot Noir. I had never had anything at that level before, the complexity. I didn't take a single sip of that wine. I did not want my sensory experience to change. I just kept smelling and sniffing and writing notes, and I have pages of notes of describing the transitions that that wine went through in one evening. And I still came back the next morning, and I came in at like 6 o'clock in the morning to smell that glass of wine again that was still sitting in the cellar, and I started adding to the pages of notes again. And that, to me, was what I said, wow, when a wine can tell a story like this, just think of the conversation with people. It can evoke what, where will this experience go with the people that are enjoying it? And that's kind of where I got into studying how to grow a wine that needed nothing other than the grapes being in such harmony and such balance that they could tell that sort of a story. But from here, in the story that California had to tell. And so that was kind of my journey where I started. I left the restaurant industry and started studying viticulture and went to work for Warren Dutton. And, you know, that was kind of where it all started. So
was, do we hold the 78 Romani Conti responsible for that transition?
Partially, yeah. Yes, maybe predominantly.
But a bottle of white can do, change a man's career completely.
Yeah. A bottle of Romani Conti, when I started reading about that vineyard, you know, everything was about the site, the land, the soil, the cultivation, the replanting, you know, what Aubert de Vallon was doing, taking it over from the heritage that he was receiving it from, and how he was aspiring to improve it, the biodynamic practices, the organic farming, the removal of synthetic fertilizers and improving the quality through that. All of those things made me realize that I grew up on a 250-acre ranch. This product is a connection to the land, and this is my opportunity to have a career connected to the land that's very scientific, very artistic, very, very full of hospitality. It's very social. I don't think I've ever enjoyed a bottle of wine by myself. It's always with friends and with family. And, you know, I might have a beer by myself when I am done with a hard day's work, but a glass of wine, it's, you know, I look at my wife and I say, would you like a glass of wine? What do you feel like it? You know, it's just this very social, it's full of hospitality and generosity. And so, So it was a lot of things, I would say, that led me down that path. But growing up on a ranch property and seeing this wine that was such an incredible expression of a single place, that was the moment that I realized that, you know, that this was an opportunity in California for us to pay attention to the site more and let the fruit express the vineyard more than, you know, well, let's face it, Burgundy doesn't have a term winemaker. There is no term that describes a winemaker in Burgundy. There is a vigneron, which is what I consider myself, someone you know, cultivates the vines, but then oversees, you know, I'll never dismiss the intensity of the work that happens in the cellar. But if what you do in the vineyard isn't at the highest level, you'll never get the highest level in the cellar. It just doesn't correlate. You can't retroactively repair mistakes from farming in the cellar. You can mask them, you can attempt to mask them, but that's exactly what you're doing. So if your farming isn't excellent, then you can't expect more out of your wine than what your farming was from your cellar practices. So,
you know, it's so fascinating to me that Romani Conti is the most iconic brand in the world.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson,